Well, this term on the Sunday mornings, we're going to be looking at St. John's Gospel. We're going to be going through it at somewhat breakneck speed. We're only going through the first half of the Gospel, and we're only going to spend one Sunday on a chapter, so it's going to have to be quite selective. And we're starting off, not in chapter 1, but in chapter 2. I hope that won't seem to you too strange. In fact, if we look immediately at my text for today, chapter 2, verse 11, I think perhaps we may get an idea that this may be as good a place as any to start, and from some points of view, a better place, because we've got a real bird's eye view, a real eye-opener into what the gospel is all about, and about who Jesus Christ himself. Verse 11, the end of the story of the turning of water into wine. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. From many points of view, it's a very extraordinary miracle, this first one recorded in John's Gospel, the turning of water into wine. And in fact, some commentators have found it so extraordinary that they've really rather tut-tutted and been a bit cross. They've said, for instance, you see, that what a waste. It was just a luxury. I mean, it was fair enough when Jesus saw somebody sick to go and heal him. There was a crying need needing to be met. But just to provide some wine at a wedding, well, that was a bit frivolous, wasn't it? To work a miracle just in that sort of situation. And again, one gets the impression that certainly if all the water available was turned into wine, the amount of wine there was quite prodigious, around about 150 gallons. And people are saying, is this just sort of something to make us goggle in amazement? Surely not. Jesus, when he worked miracles, never wanted us to goggle in amazement. Indeed, that was the thing that he was always, in a sense, afraid of when he worked in a miracle, that people would goggle in amazement at the wonder and not see the inner meaning. And that little expression perhaps gives us the clue, the inner meaning. And let's look back again at our text, verse 11. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory. You see, John doesn't call it a miracle. And in his gospel, John doesn't talk about miracles. His regular word for what we usually term miracles, his regular word for a miracle is a sign. Because every miracle that Jesus does in John's eyes isn't just a marvel. It isn't just something to gape at in astonishment. It's a sign. It signifies to us something spiritual and invisible. It's got a secret inner meaning. Not all that secret. We've got to search for it. But it tells us something. And John declares here again in verse 11 that through this sign, Jesus manifested forth his glory. It's an eye-opener, a bird's eye view of who Jesus is and what it means to believe on him, which is what his disciples immediately did. So let's have a look at the miracle. And let's ask some questions about it, which I hope will take us into the heart of its meaning. Here's the first question. What was the need to be met? What was the need to be met? Well, at first sight, you've got the answer to that question in verse 3. When the wine failed, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." See, there it was. There they were at the reception, everything going swimmingly, and then suddenly the wine runs out. My goodness, that's going to put a panic up the master of ceremonies. What's he going to do? There's plenty of water, but that's going to be a bit sort of thin for a wedding. That's not going to cheer people up very much, is it? So on one level, that was the need. They'd run out of wine at the wedding. But for those with eyes to see, there's a deeper need. Because all the time at the wedding, in the background, in verse 6, there were six stone jars standing there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Six stone jars for the Jewish rites of purification, water jars. And those stone pots, although they said nothing, were very eloquent. Certainly they were eloquent to somebody like Jesus Christ. Now, I meant to check up on this illustration. I feel rather nervous about it because it's a medical one, and I expect I'll get it all wrong, but you'll have to bear with me. Supposing you go into somebody's house and into his bedroom, and you find there a kidney machine. We used to hear a lot about kidney machines a few years ago. One doesn't seem to hear about them nowadays, so perhaps they've gone out. I don't know. But anyway, supposing you find a kidney machine. Now, you only have to see that machine. No, nothing has to be said. And you know that in that home there is a desperate need. One of the people in that home, his blood is being inadequately cleansed, and it's got to have this artificial additional means of cleansing his blood. And just seeing that machine standing there is a real cry of anguish. Now, there's something similar to that about those six water pots. Because they were water pots concerned with the Jewish rites of purification. Inadequate cleansing. What can water do to make you clean? Well, it can clean your body. It can give you an outward cleansing. But what about the real purification? If we're going to be pure in heart before God, water's not going to do anything that's any good there. You need something powerful, more real, more vivid. Something that's going to go to the heart of things. There's only water there. And when Mary comes to Jesus and says to him, "They have no wine," Jesus, in a sense, echoes that, yes. They have no wine. We read in our psalm that verse that speaks about wine that makes glad the heart of man. Wine that makes glad the heart. And there was no wine. Only this weak, ineffectual water was meant to cleanse and purify and couldn't do it. And those water pots speak eloquently to Christ of a need of cleansing that is not being met. A cleansing that's so necessary and vital, and nothing's being done about it. You remember that Christ spoke about his coming and what he came to bring. And he described it like this. He said, "No man puts new wine in old bottles." He's come to bring the new wine, something that's going to give you a joy within by dealing with the troubles within. And his mother comes and says, "They have no wine." And Jesus says, "No, they've no wine. And if only I could give them that wine that will make glad their hearts." And so he replies in that rather strange way to his mother. Verse 4, he says to her, "Woman, what have I to do with you?" We both see a need, but the need that you've seen is such a petty one. I've seen the real one. Are we on about the same thing? So, what was the need to be met? Not just that the wine had run out, but that they had no effectual means of inner cleansing. So that was the need to be met. Secondly, second question, how was Christ to meet it? How was Christ to meet it? And the answer comes again in his answer to his mother. Verse 4, Jesus said to her, O woman, what have you to do with me? My hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come. The need was for effectual cleansing. How was Christ to meet it? Answer, when his hour came. When his hour came. And what was his hour? Well, let's turn on to chapter 12 to get the answer. Chapter 12, verse 23. Jesus answered them, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. The hour of Jesus' glory is the hour of his death and resurrection. By dying, he is going to bring about and release much fruit. See this again in chapter 12 and verse 27. Facing his death, he speaks to himself. He says, now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. There's the word again. No, for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify thy name. Then a voice came from heaven, I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. So back to chapter 2. But we see there, you see, that the hour, Christ's hour, the hour of his glory, the hour when he achieves all that he's come into the world to do, is the hour of his death and his resurrection and sending of the Spirit. That's when he achieves it. How is Christ to meet the need? When his hour comes. And if he is to do anything now to meet the need that's before him, he can only act in a way that's going to be a sign, an anticipation, a foreshadowing of what he is going to do fully when his hour comes. What he does now is a sign of what comes then. And in many ways, a wedding was a good place for Jesus to do a sign. We've referred already to his remarks about new wine and new wineskins and so on. He referred to himself also, you may remember, as the heavenly bridegroom. The Pharisees came to him on one occasion wanting to know why his disciples didn't fast. And he replied to them, can the children of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as the bridegroom is with them, they will not fast. But the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away. Then they will fast. You see, he saw himself as the heavenly bridegroom, come to make a wedding feast with his people. And so at this wedding, he works a sign of what he is to do when his hour comes. And the sign he works is to turn that water in the water pots for the Jewish purification, to turn it into wine. What does that sign signify? Well, we can trace several things. First of all, it speaks of replacing formal purification with real heart satisfaction. They have no wine. Water isn't going to deal with the aching need of the heart, not in this spiritual sense. And so Christ comes to do away with the formal, ineffectual purification and to replace it with real heart satisfaction. There's a meaning in this sign. And what he gives as he turns the water into wine is in every way better. He gives to those at that wedding and he gives to you, to me, something that is better than law-keeping and ceremonies. That was what those six water pots were all about. The Jewish rites of purification. Oh, and there were so many of them, so many rites, so many laws to be kept. It was such an effort and a toil. And yet they were all ineffectual. None of them achieved anything. And in the place of those ineffectual rites, Christ comes to bring something that is better than law-keeping, something that's rich and free. Moses, the one from whom the Jewish laws, or the one with whom the Jewish laws and rites originated, the one who set them down, he turned water into something once, you may remember. At the beginning of the plagues in Egypt that Moses worked as God's servant and instrument, the first of those plagues was to turn the water of the Nile not into wine, but into blood. And that was a sign of judgment on a nation that was rebelling against God and disobeying him, not keeping his laws. And law only brings condemnation. Law says, do this, do this, do this. Do this and you'll live. But because it doesn't help you to do this, it's saying in effect, do this or you'll die. Law brings condemnation. The water is turned to blood. But Christ brings liberty, gladness, sins forgiven. Water is turned into wine that gladdens the heart of man. He gives them something better than law-keeping. Again, he gives them something better than the natural creation. Remember at the end of the story, they brought the new wine to the master of the feast, and when he tasted it, he said, look, usually people serve the best wine at the beginning, and then later on when people won't know the difference, what isn't so good, but now you've brought on something that's better. Because anything that Christ gives is better than anything the world can give. This natural world has many riches in it. But Christ gives something better. Something that speaks of the world that is to come. Better than the natural creation. Again, what Christ gives, he gives the best at the end. The best at the end. Look in verse 10. Here's the master of ceremonies. Every man serves the good wine first, and when men have drunk freely, then the poor wine, but you have kept the good wine until now. With Christ, the best is at the end. Because what comes at the end is the final thing, the thing that lasts. Do you know what it is which the man of the world dreads and the Christian longs for? If you've heard me in the past, you probably do. It's the morning after the night before. Yes, you can wake up in the morning after the night before with your hangover. Now, in a deeper sense, for the Christian, the best is yet to be. The morning after the night before, heaven's morning breaks, earth's vain shadows flee, we sing in one of the hymns. Heaven's morning breaks. Christ gives the best at the end. This world can offer many things, perhaps, but none of them are the final thing. They're all going to run out, like that wine at the wedding. Every single thing that the world offers will come to an end. It will finish and run out. But what Christ gives lasts. The best at the end. So what was the need to be met? That need of inner purification. How was Christ to need it, to meet it? When his hour came and he can only act now in a way which is a sign of what he will do when his hour comes. And he gives the wine of heart satisfaction instead of formal purification, something better than law-keeping, free forgiveness, something better than natural creation, a new creation as you're made new at heart, something that keeps the best for the end so that we have a hope that is everlasting. Final question, who benefits? Who benefits? Well, again, you can answer on two levels. On one level, the ruler of the feast benefited, and the guests. He was in a right panic, wasn't he, when the wine ran out? And then suddenly there's this new supply. And the guests, they might have had no wine. They might have had to stop drinking, but there is fresh wine there. But see what's said, verse 9. When the steward of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it had come from. He didn't know where it had come from. Many press round Christ. Many perhaps are the recipients of God's blessings, but perhaps unconsciously, they don't know where those blessings come from. They don't know what are the true blessings to be looked for. The wine that will replace the futile water. The wine that will keep the best for the end. They don't know. It's there available. But they don't know and have no means, therefore, of appropriating it and making it their own. So having said that the ruler of the feast and the guests benefit, let's go on to a deeper answer. And the deeper answer, perhaps, is for servants, or let's call them disciples who obey. Again, verse 9, you see that the steward didn't know, but the servants who had drawn the water knew. They knew. And what had been said to them, verse 5, his mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Do whatever he tells you. Now, one more cross-reference in John. John 15, verse 14. John 15, 14. You are my friends if you do what I command you. There's that phrase again. No longer do I call you servants. It was the servants who drew the water. For the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I've called you friends, for all that I've heard from my Father, I have made known to you. Back to John 2. You see, if you begin as a servant, doing whatever Jesus tells you, you move on to become a friend who knows what are the blessings Jesus gives. And so at the end, in verse 11, we see that this first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. They've begun as servants. They've done what he commanded, and now they know and they believe. And the way to know, in a sense, is to know that you don't know. To come humbly to Jesus. To see that he is this tremendous person who's come to bring the wine of true heart satisfaction that satisfies our deepest needs and keeps the best for the end. And who, when his hour comes, will do all that is required to make that available for you and for me, and to believe in him and realize something of his glory and have a share in it.